Good morning and welcome to the who knows what episode it is of the Canuck Crosscast. We are post-USCX series, post-North American World Cups. I'm back sitting in Canada. Jen is still sitting in Canada. And we're going to recap some of that, talk about what's coming up, and just catch up on what was a pretty insane 6 weeks of bike racing.
Yeah, I'm glad you made it back. We were just talking about how sadly Avery has not made it back to Canada yet.
Avery now lives in America and will for the foreseeable future, unfortunately for him. He, he was supposed to be back on Tuesday like I was, but somehow his first flight got canceled because of thunderstorms, and he was supposed to go through Chicago, and then he got rerouted to go through Washington, and his second flight was canceled because the pilot didn't show up? Not really sure what the deal with that one is. So then, the rules right now are that you need a negative PCR test within 72 hours of your departure. So we planned ahead because we were worried that the tests were going to take, you know, they say they take 2 to 3 days, which is 72 hours. So on Friday at Cincinnati, we went and we all got our PCR tests, kind of like as close to when our flight would, you know, to give us the maximum amount of time to get the negative results. The drawback of that is if flights get canceled and changed, your PCR test is no longer valid. So since his flight was canceled until the next day, he had to actually spend an extra day in Washington. So he's been there for like 2 days now, and I'm assuming he'll actually get home this evening. I hope.
Yeah.
Because
we're hoping for him too, but I think he's had a nice little kind of forced vacation there. So he
I got hope
to do
so.
Some sightseeing.
I was telling him, I was like, man, I've driven adjacent to Washington a lot of times, and I have never, ever, ever actually been into the city. So at least it's not like, I don't know what the worst place to be stuck in, but Washington's one of the better places to be stuck in.
Yeah, if you had the hierarchy of places to be stuck, at least he wasn't stuck in the airport, too. He could just go do things, which was nice.
Yeah, his plan was to drop off the bag, stay a couple nights in a hotel, and go and see, I think he said, the Natural History Museum and a bunch of other cool things. I don't know. All the other stuff that's in Washington that people go see.
Traveling within North America is so much harder than traveling within Europe. Is this true or false?
How is this not true? It's like the driving that we did on this trip to do 3 World Cups was insane. Like, we went from Iowa City... No, we went from, sorry, back up even before that. We went from Waterloo, Wisconsin.
Let's start from the beginning.
Okay. So, this is the rapid fire trip itinerary. Vancouver to Roanoke, Roanoke to Connecticut, Connecticut to Rochester, Rochester to Connecticut, Connecticut to Baltimore, Baltimore to Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh to Wisconsin, Wisconsin to Iowa City, Iowa City to Fayetteville, Fayetteville to Iowa City, Iowa City to Cincinnati, Cincinnati to Vancouver.
Over how many weeks?
6 weeks. So we realized when we were in Iowa City, Goss realized this, that was the first time we'd stayed in one place for longer than 6 days.
And I think that's what maybe made it seem so hectic, because when you're, like, I think that maybe traveling in Europe for cross is easier than what you guys did here, but traveling for mountain biking is not as easy because the drives are longer and it's like mountains. But when you're racing in Belgium, you have your base, and you have a base, and everything is like a drive from there. Maybe you add an overnight, but...
I remember when I did that season in Belgium, Spa was one of the races, and Spa is like on the far eastern border of Belgium, and we were kind of staying on the western side, and we actually decided it was a 3-hour drive, and there was like a discussion... that it was too far to go to the race, so we didn't go. We're like, 3 hours, that's too far, I can't do that race. Like, that's in a different world. And now, it just made perfect sense when we were living and staying in Belgium. You're like, oh, there's a race that's like 45 minutes away or half an hour away most other times. Like, why would I drive 3 hours? And now I look at that, having done the great North American Midwest road trip, and having just, like, racing out here in general, and even going to, like, quote-unquote local races... I'm like, 3 hours? That's nothing. Like, there's hardly a race on the calendar within 3 hours. There isn't a UCI race on the calendar within 3 hours. There isn't a UCI race on the calendar within I'm just gonna say 20, within 20 hours of driving.
I mean, it just becomes normalized how much you have to travel.
Yep. It's a lot of traveling. But that's okay. I'm very happy to be home. Very happy to sleep in my own bed and use my own coffee machine and do work at my desk and all these like very mundane things that are really, really nice right now. Hang out with my dog. It's good stuff.
You just get to settle. Like, you don't have to process. Like, there's less processing to do. Like, maybe there's more chores that you do when you come home, and there's like a busyness to it. Like, sometimes I come back from a trip and I rush into being busy again and don't just take time to just chill out, like, and decompress and like put the trip away. Like, I'll come, like, when I came back from Nationals, I like immediately went to Canmore, and then I was immediately back to work, so I didn't really get to enjoy being home until maybe now, like 3-4 weeks later, because you need that time to decompress mentally, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's always an element of that, like, I have to clean my gutters. I'm probably not doing that when I'm on the road. Actually, I'm definitely. If I went to an Airbnb and they were like, hey, can you clean the gutters for us while you're there? I don't think I would respond.
I think the closest thing we ever came to doing chores while we were traveling was that lady we stayed with in Waterloo a couple of years ago when we helped her like weed and pick vegetables from her garden.
Yeah, we mostly helped her pick vegetables and it was pretty good.
Yeah, it was like almost a chore, but it was also very rewarding because she had like an amazingly bountiful garden.
Ooh, hold up here. We got an update on the Avery situation. He is waiting on his Uber to go to the airport. So far, the man is en route, and he sent me a picture of him in front of the White House and the Capitol building. So, oh, and in front of is that the Lincoln Memorial? What's the giant spiky one that is in all the, like, Americans are going to not like that. I don't know this. The giant one that's like a weird big pole that's also a statue.
I'm not very well versed in historical monuments or.
Okay, I'm sorry, Americans. He also went to the International Spy Museum. I'm getting like live. Avery is live texting me his trip right now.
Oh, so, this is great.
sounds like despite still not being home, he probably learned a lot more than I managed to do about American history over 6 weeks, and he learned more than that in one day. So that's exciting. I'm a little jealous.
Well, so over those 6 weeks, I guess we talked last after you'd done a few UCI weekends. We had Goss on and the real European cyclocross man who had some. It was pretty interesting. Like, I had some big takeaways from that conversation. I re-listened to part of it and was like, wow, it's just our perception of European reality is a little bit different than what it actually is. So yeah, that was our last episode. Interesting. If people want to go check that out. We don't know what episode we're on or what episode that was, but it was a good chat. But we totally dropped the ball on catching up after the World Cup week. I was like, should I ask if they want to do a podcast? But I think you guys were just kind of cracked.
We were so cracked. The amount of conversation, like, it started picking up at the end of that week, but it was like basically from Fayetteville through to probably the Tuesday after Jingle Cross, we would just like be sitting at the table, kind of staring into space quietly. And it wasn't that we were sick of each other, because there's four of us traveling. Leif Rogers, who's a U23 from my area, who traveled with us for the World Cup block, and then Avery and Gus and myself. And it's like, it wasn't that we were sick of each other. It wasn't that we didn't like each other. It's like, we were so tired that our brains couldn't think of conversation topics. You're just kind of sitting there existing, waiting for, I don't know, your bike ride to start, or for when you get to eat,
waiting for glue to dry.
Basically. And then we kind of came out of it, but I was talking to lots of athletes, like even at Cincinnati, who were just, like, people were just wiped. They were cracked. They were, like, spending extra days napping, doing all these things, like, super unmotivated to go training. It was, some people obviously held together their form better than others, but nobody was feeling fresh after that 6 week pull.
No, I can't believe anyone. I can't see any situation where people would be. So I guess like then Cincinnati. So I guess, do you want to, like, World Cup? Quick World Cup run through. So you did, you didn't do all of the races in that block.
Only two people. Two people did all of the races in that block. Gasa and Kerry Warner. And they both had, well, actually they both had, they, the reason they both did it was because of the USCX series. So maybe let's jump back or jump forward or whatever way you want to look at it. A step and talk about that, because the USCX series is a wrap. We finished it up in Cincinnati. It was all televised for the first time ever. I think the coverage got better as the series went on. I watched some of the Rochester stuff, and they were definitely still figuring things out in that first weekend. But by the time we got to Cincinnati, like, I watched days one and day two, actually. I watched the coverage from that, and it's like, yeah, it's not Eurosport yet, but you could follow the race. You knew what was happening. I thought Jeremy and Marty did a really good job with the commentary. Yeah.
So did you watch Cincinnati day one, like that day, in preparation for day two?
I watched Cincinnati day one. No, I think I watched it after the fact on Sunday evening. And then I also watched
it. It would have made a big difference because the conditions changed entirely.
Yeah, basically my takeaway from Cincinnati day one, I was like, ooh, really should have made that group there, Michael. And that was it. But yeah, I think the series, it was interesting. The overall results, unfortunately, were, I don't know if you want to say skewed or kind of became about consistent participation as much as like winning the races. Now, I have no doubt that Kerry was like the person who deserved to win that. He was on the podium 1,000 times and he won that last race. He caught Bastian. So like, if I had one complaint, it's really that the Jingle Cross having two USCX races followed by the World Cup really, and not having an overall prize purse for the USCX really disincentivized people from racing that Saturday, myself included, because the World Cup's a big race and it's important. And as good as it is to be on TV and representing your sponsors on GCN, at some point something has to give. And I think, like a lot of athletes, like, I decided that the World Cup was more important than racing on Saturday. Most other people decided that. The only ones who didn't, Kerry and Gasa, had other financial incentives for racing the USCX that were written into their contracts.
Right. And again, that's like picking your battles. I remember trying to pick all three battles in Iowa at Jingle Cross. And that's when they had the World Cup Saturday, C1 Sunday. And yeah, I died on Sunday. It was not good. It'd be very hard to do.
Yeah, it's remarkable, actually, that, like, both of them, both Kerry and Goss, had pretty... Kerry didn't have a very good Friday race, but he had, like... He was second on the Saturday race and was... I think he finished a spot or maybe two spots behind me on Sunday. Like, he had a good World Cup. And then Goss also had, like, his best ever World Cup finish, which is kind of ridiculous that they held it together. But I just... Knowing how I felt even on Saturday after that night race, and then... Knowing how I felt on Monday after the World Cup, it was like, not a chance was that going to work for me.
Yeah, the last one was your best World Cup. You got better as this whole thing went on.
I did. My worst one was Fayetteville. I just didn't have a good race. But yeah, it was nice. Like, I went into this whole block feeling like I belonged inside the top 20 at these races for the World Cups, and like didn't quite put it together in Waterloo and Fayetteville. Fayetteville, I just wasn't feeling great. Waterloo, I just didn't. You know, there's a difference between not feeling great and not racing great. And I'm not sure which one's less frustrating. At least when you don't race great, you know there was more there. When you don't feel great, it's like, in some ways, you could find solace or comfort, I guess, in the fact that, like, you did everything you could. But on the other hand, there's more question marks. It's like, why was I slow today? And you don't really have an answer. So that was a little bit more of the Fayetteville experience.
Yeah, I find when you have those days where you don't feel good, that it's harder to get the best out of myself on those days. Like, it just feels hard, so you have to fight yourself more than fight the race. And, you know, maybe that's just like a headspace thing I need to work on, but it's like, it's easier to go hard and to race well and to be super focused when you feel good, because then you... At least when I feel good, I don't actually feel anything. You know, you're not like processing, wow, my body hurts right now. You just process, I just need to go faster. And you just kind of bypass that suffering part.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's like it's a negative feedback loop when you're not feeling good. Like everything, you're not feeling good. Something is hard. You tell yourself it's hard, and it just feeds into itself over and over again. You're riding around someone who you don't normally ride with, and then that tells you that it's even harder than it should be. And it's just like I try when I'm not feeling great in a race. I really try to focus on just almost like, you know, letting myself get dragged into the fight. That's kind of the language that I've been thinking about a little bit more, and just focusing on like, that group, I'm going to stick in that group. I don't care who's in it. I don't care if I normally beat them. I don't care if I normally lose to them. Like, that's my group. And letting it, it's easier said than done, but I've been trying to focus a lot this year on like, so much of the not feeling good thing. Yes, it's physical, but it's also so mental. And trying to make a situation where it's like, even if the physical isn't there, you can still do your best effort on the day. Because there's almost a separation between those two things, right? There's feeling great, having a great race because of that. And then there's feeling crappy and executing as best you possibly could. And I feel like that, if I can do that, I can at least leave the weekend happy with it. If I don't feel good and I don't execute well, then it's just like what are you even doing here? Why are you even at the race?
Yeah, you gave it up. Like, it's, you have to at least bring the fight. And I think we train enough that we both know, like, there's a certain minimum level that even if I feel crappy and maybe my form isn't ideal, I should still be able to at least bring a certain level. I should be able to at least bring the focus to, like, race, to get through the race. Like, it's one of those things, like, you gotta finish, one. And two, yeah, just bring the fight. And it's hard. It's so hard because it's so easy. I think maybe it's a bit of a pride thing to like, if you can let go of your pride, your ego, of where you feel you should be, and just accept where you are, then you can race better wherever you may be in a field. And we've all struggled with that, where you kind of, like you said, believe I'm a top 20 rider or want to be a top 20 rider. And when that's not real, then you have to let go of the ego, let go of the pride, and just be like, I'm racing for these other positions and it still matters. And regardless of what your expectations or hopes were coming into it.
Yeah, and I think I've been thinking lots about that too lately. Like the you know, we talked about this, we've been looking at the start line board and everything earlier this year. But even the who you're around, it's a funny line between like acknowledging the traits and the characteristics of the riders you're around, because that's going to help you beat them, but not getting too caught up in who they are and where you usually finish relative to them. Like, I don't think anything good comes out of analyzing your performance based off how other riders are doing. That's just, what if that person's like, what if you see so-and-so ahead of you and you're like, ooh, I must be having a bad day. It's like, well, no, maybe they're just having a great day. Right? Like, you can't assess your own performance based off how someone else is doing. It doesn't, and I know there's a certain element when you're coming to winning races and you want to win a race, it's like, that's all that matters. But at the same time, when you're racing in the mid pack of a World Cup, it's such a different experience. Like, no, it doesn't matter. Of course you want to beat them, but you can't get caught up on who it is that's ahead of you, because it's just giving yourself all these signals that like probably aren't that helpful to your actual race. And both ways, like we were talking about before, like sometimes I'm in a group and you're with, you know, with some like fast Belgian guys. And I did this in the Iowa World Cup. I probably could have finished higher than I did. But I was in the group and I went, oh, these people are better than me. I'm going to sit at the back of this group. And the way to win those groups in Iowa is to get to Crumpet first. I probably lost out on the move that went for a top 15 because I was too far back in the group. Not because I didn't have the legs, but because I was too far back in the group. And it was mostly just out of intimidation. I looked at that group and I went, ooh, these guys are pretty good. Like, this is a good group for me to hang out in. I should just be back here. And if I were to do it again, it's like, no, I'm feeling good. I'm going to ride at the front of this because that's where I want to be and that's what I can do.
Yeah. And it's like gauging those tactics, because sometimes the tactic is like, okay, just like you got to bide your time and sit in, but, and you don't want to be that guy who misplayed their cards, right? It's easier just to like hold your hand than it is to actually play. But it's like what Goss is saying about people like racing not to lose rather than actually racing to win. And that was, again, I think we talked about this like last year sometime too, where it's like every single position, like imagine if you were in that group and that was to win the race. I think if you had framed it that way, like this battle here, these people is like, that is literally first place. If I win this group, you would have like naturally, you would have been like, I need to be in position to win, as opposed to like sit in. But because it was like a mid pack and you're racing for like really good positions, but it wasn't like winning, then you're willing to kind of like cut your losses. We're more loss averse by nature than incentivized, I think.
For sure. It's like, you look at that result, you're like, ooh, what did I get? 18th? 18th is pretty good. I mean, I think we were racing for 14th through 20th in the group. It's like, ooh, 18th is pretty good. If I do what I'm doing, I'll get that, or right around it, right? As opposed to being like, you know what's really good? 14th. Or like, do you know what I really want to get? 14th, and I'm willing to get 20th because of that. Anyways, it was an interesting race for me, because in the past I've had a couple top 20 World Cups leading up to that, but on very, very different courses. I had one in Cross Vegas where literally there was like a group of 16 European riders battling out at front, and then it was like myself and Jeremy Powers and someone else, I forget who it was, for 16th through 18th. And it was like such a different experience, because I wasn't in the race in the same way. It was like 16 people and then the three of us just riding as hard as we could. And then in Dendermonde, I was literally running around a muddy field, and there was no tactics, there was no bunch racing, there was no nothing. You just like were racing around other people as opposed to racing against them. So this was my first time getting to the end of it and being in those battles and being like, I could have done that differently and finished higher, but also the first time that I felt like I was in my element in that group, you know, call it the second or third group of Euro guys who are still like very fast racers, very smart technically, very smart tactically, have, you know, win their fair share of races when they're doing those French Cups or whatever they are, like, yeah, it was different. Sure. Like, just a different experience.
You were in the mix. Like, the fields were legit. And, like, those, like, everyone there, like, holds it down. So it's absolutely, like, that's a legit top 20 and, like, a solid ride. Like, if you look at, you know, like, it's, and again, like, the difference between, like, 18th and 25th, like, numerically might not seem like a lot, but there's, like, there's these, like, thresholds that, like, just something about like those like like the 10, 20, 30, there are legitimately, I think, these thresholds where it is a barrier, like in some ways, to get past. It is an arbitrary number, but there's something about those tens that is like a real barrier.
Oh, absolutely. And especially I think with the North American World Cups is just the way the results break down. I know we're never looking at I'm never racing the North American, so to speak, but there are 20 or like 22 or something like that European guys who were good enough to bother coming, right? And that's a real drop off too. Like in a European World Cup, the battling is so, the top 20, top 22, whatever it is pretty much the same, plus Matthew and Wout and Tom Pidcock, right? Like, you get a couple more people that weren't there. But besides that, like, those people all come to race the World Cups. They're World Cup racers. And then the European World Cups, that second group is slightly slower, but there's just a ton of people who are all around the same level. And I don't think at the North American World Cups there's quite the depth in the 20 to 40th spot. There's definitely not the depth in the 20 to 40th. So I'd say with these races more than any, there's a much more noticeable jump from finishing 24th to 18th, because it's like 24th, the gaps between riders are, one, a little bit bigger, and two, you're mostly competing against the people that you compete against on a regular basis, right? But then when you shift inside that top 20, you're competing against the top 20 field at any World Cup. Those are the people that are always there. They do this all the time, and it just has a different, yeah, it has a different feel. The margin for error is much smaller than it would be in that next group back.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to take a look, because like Zonhoven, like they're already back into like the next World Cups this past weekend, so like they would have all gone home after Iowa, and then they raced a World Cup on Sunday in Zonhoven. It'd be interesting to kind of to look at the fields and just see where, because I think there's definitely a couple people who didn't come over, but almost all of the Euros went back over and were, would have been at this World Cup.
I mean, absolutely. Like Toon Aerts won Zonhoven. He was, you know, he was there the whole time. Lars Vanderhaar was second at Zonhoven. He was there the whole trip. Like the only person that wasn't was Lauren Sweek.
But even Alvarado down on the women's side.
Yeah, Alvarado, even down, like you go through into that top 20 and most of those people were there. Once you get past that top 20 again, it's like, that's when you start getting into that, that like, I don't know if you want to call them the second tier of Euro guys, but the ones
the
who like
zone.
Yeah, they make their living by doing some of the World Cups, doing some of the French races, doing some of the Czech races, doing some of the super prestigious they have contracts for. It's just a different, it's a little bit of a different crew, or they were road racing and doing other things for that first part of the year. So, yeah, it'll be, anyways, all that to say, it was that Iowa World Cup, although numerically it wasn't my best World Cup, felt like my best World Cup.
I was stoked to see it. I watched that race too, and it was at least for the women's race, it was super interesting, the run-up on it, which was not a run-up. It was rideable in the women's race, which in the past, like last time, it was not rideable. And even in the men's race, I think almost everyone was running last time. But this year, I think it was just dry, which I think really made all the difference.
Well, and it was really fascinating too, because the run-up was a ride-up. But if you went into the ride-up with more than three people, someone was going to mess it up. Even if you went into the run-up with three people, someone might mess it up. Like, it was just hard enough that it wasn't a sure thing you were going to make it every time. It was super rutted and bumpy with all sorts of little steps from people running it years past.
You could see it even on TV. You could see the ruts. And you could see when people would make those mistakes, it would just be like they just stall out. And if you don't stall out at the exact same time, then you're forced to stall out at inopportune moments. Then sometimes the person who initially stalled gets away, and then you get effed because you were stuck.
And later on in the weekend too, there ended up being sort of one line that was definitely better than everything else to ride up it. So it really became a race where if you were going to win your group, win your race, getting to that run up first was really important, because there was still a lot of course after that. It's actually fairly early in the lap, but it was just hard to follow anyone up it, especially if you were buried in the group, because gaps opened up, and even though there's a long climb after that, they were hard to close down.
It was totally dry all weekend though, eh?
Yep.
Nice, because the other two World Cups you did were wet.
That's Waterloo and Fayetteville. Oh, Fayetteville, definitely wet. It was probably the driest I've ever raced Iowa. But the cool...
And was everyone on intermediate tires?
Intermediates. It's not a course you can really race files on.
I guess with the grassy descent.
Yeah, the grassy descent, the ride-up, especially, required a little bit of pedaling traction. The cool thing about that course, though, and I'll pump their tires all day long. I think it's the best course in North America, bar none. It's not even really that close. And the cool thing about it is, like, it's a pretty epic feeling race when it's super muddy. It's a pretty epic feeling race when it's super dry. It's just a good all-around course. Some courses, it's like, if they aren't wet, they feel small. This one is not one of those. It feels fast and tactical, but the features are still big. The climb is still big. The ride-up / run-up is still big. The descent's still big. It still feels like World Cup caliber. more than anything else does. I'm like, this isn't to diminish Trek. That's a good course as well. It's not to diminish Fayetteville. That's a strange course. But Iowa's my favorite.
Yeah. I mean, I think it just brings variety. Like, it's hard to have that type of terrain and with the right kind of ground. Like, you need the right kind of surface and the right terrain. And then you need to make the layout of it work as well. What gearing were you running for that race? I'm just curious about setup because I
42 front, 1033 rear. So the Friday race,
okay,
I was
on
a...
That's pretty tall gear.
Well, the Friday race, I was on a 42 to a 33, and I got Avery to change it on Saturday because I was still... I was riding the ride-up on Friday, but it was hard. I was really, like, really getting bogged down on it. So we changed that. Still pretty tall, but... there's a certain element, like, because of how steep and bumpy it is, you just kind of needed to push a bigger gear just to get up it and to get traction.
Yeah, stay on the pedals. You're not spinning no matter what, so it's yeah, like, how fast can you actually move?
Exactly. There's not enough traction on your tires to spin up that thing. Like, you just need to hit it and hit it hard.
Yeah. I'm also asking because it's, I mean, what gearing you're going to run is obviously higher gearing than what I'll run, but... got some intel on the course for Nationals. And mm-hmm. So it's at Bear Mountain, which is in Langford, kind of west of Victoria. And it's at the golf course. So for the people who have done the Canada Cup there before, they'll know there's like a golf cart path that's really steep that goes up it. We don't do the whole golf cart climb, but we do the golf cart climb. And it's like a 20% paved climb in the middle of the course. Well, actually, it's not in the middle. Apparently, it's at the finish. And basically, you finish up this climb. It's like Koppenberg, except not cobbles.
Ooh.
For the finish. So I'm like thinking about my gearing, and right now I have a 36 on my bike, and I'm like, I think that is a good choice for that because at like 20%, it's like a sit and climb. Traction isn't the issue because it's paved, so it's actually like, what's your optimal climbing gear to get up that? And I don't see my, like, it's hard because, like, am I actually going to be going ever pedaling faster than I would be pedaling in, like, a 36.10? That's, like, over 40 kilometers
probably
an hour.
Not. I don't think I've ever used my 10 in a cross race. I'd be shocked if I have.
Yeah, so I'm like, if I run a 36, and I have right now, I have such a mismatch of equipment. I've got, like, a 10.36 12-speed cassette. And then I think my other one is a 1028 or maybe a 1030 because just what I could find. So I think I go with the wide range one for the climb. Mm-hmm. And then on my 11 speed bike, I run a 38 because that's the smallest I have and then have an 1136, which is mm-hmm. pretty similar. Hopefully I don't need to be pitting and changing bikes. But yeah, that's kind of the big feature of the course. And then there's like a gradual uphill drag after it. And then it's just, I think, going to be a lot of like, flat golf course grass corners, but there will be like at least some descending because
that's how elevation works.
Yeah, it's how it works. You have to start and you have to do a loop
every lap. We just do a steep climb and we never come down.
Witchcraft.
Yeah,
so the intel I got on the course. And then there's like a small like kind of two-part step run up, but not a huge one.
Okay. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Like, they have done a race at Bear Mountain before. It's been a long time. And they've done mountain bike races, of course, but there has been a cross race there, but it's not part of the normal Cross on the Rock series. So this is a new course, I think, for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, it'll be exciting. While we were talking, I'm going to come and do a local cross race down your way in a few weeks to do a race before I do a big race. So we'll see. It'll be fun.
Come race at Aldergrove, give them a shout out. That's part of the VCXC series run by Matt Hornland and crew, who are also works at Easton, but it'll be a good race.
Yeah, and it's 2 days, which is also good. I get to come and race. I'm getting really tired of going. I've been practicing a bit and I get really tired of doing laps around my park, so it'll be fun to go and do a little bit of a race. I mean, we won't do like a full Nationals preview, but I want to like say Sydney McGill crushed it in Cincinnati. She was on the C1 podium.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was, and she's been having, I think in a lot of ways it was coming. Like, I've been watching snippets of her races when I've been getting ready, and she has that, like, she's been starting fast for most of the things and then sometimes blowing up. But I think at least I'm a big believer that, like, you do that enough times and you get used to writing at that speed, eventually it's just going to stick. And
yep.
It kind of stuck on Saturday. Like, she still got, like, yeah, of course she still got popped off Megs's wheel, as literally everybody does every single weekend of the year. But she held on for third against, like, a pretty stacked field. The only people that aren't there are, I guess, Clara Hansinger and Katie Klaus. Like, it's, everyone's there. This is, that's amazing. It was such a good ride for her.
I saw that and I was like, am I seeing this right? Because that is legit. And I looked at the results. Like,
also of note, zero Americans on the C1 podium in America, which I thought was kind of hilarious.
Yes, the international crowd. Because yeah. Magali won. So this was in Cincinnati on Saturday. Magali won. Caroline Mani was second. And then Sydney was third.
Yeah.
So big international smackdown there.
Oh, yeah.
Love to see it.
It was awesome. And then also, going down the list, like, not to, you know, shouldn't bury the lead here. Not only did Sydney have a great race, but I think we won... Let's see, Ava Holmgren won the women's junior race that day. Ian Ackert, also a Canadian, won the men's junior race. And then on Sunday, if you look at the Sunday list, Ian Ackert won the men's junior race, and Isabella Holmgren won the women's, and Ava was second. And then a British woman was third in the women's junior race. So, yeah, pretty Young good talent. Weekend for Canada. Pretty good, like... A lot of good kids coming up. A lot of, you know, people who have been good for a long time, like Sydney, kind of coming into their own this season and putting together really good results. Like, it's awesome to see.
Oh, and it was awesome. They did not the whole same circuit you did, but they did, like, a good bulk of it, that race block. So they've got a lot of racing under their belt. Is Sydney, like, is she still under 23? Or is she elite and proper?
Oh, are you now scouting your competition here?
I just need to know who to be scared of. I'm scared of everybody right now because I just live in my own little world where I ride around a park by myself and get chased by dogs.
So that's reasonable, and I think, because
I'm not terrible, but
I was checking out Instagram yesterday and I saw that Derek G is making his cyclocross debut, and I was like, "Oh dang, them were some Olympic watts." And then I saw him try to get on a bike, and I'm less concerned now, but you can't count out the Olympic watts, or as Ruby says, let me just read you what Ruby said. I think she said, "We'll see how his approach of throwing watts at the problem works for cyclocross."
Throw watts at it.
Just throw some watts at it. It'll be
no
fun.
No problems. That's so good. Well, yeah, like Ruby too. She's another one who hasn't raced yet, and she'll be coming out fast. So I think they're the same age.
Sydney McGill is 22 years old. So that would still under make 23. You under 23.
And
no,
Ruby,
it says elite.
Is...
She's not an under 23 because of the black magic of cyclocross.
One sec here. We just got to figure this out.
No, see, okay. Cyclocross 24, which if anyone doesn't use cyclocross 24, this is what you
should
be
doing. No, she and Ruby. Yes, sorry. Cyclocross 24 is the best website for results, schedules, anything literally cross.
They even put up the UCI racing ranking before the UCI ranking is published. Like, they go through and do the math themselves.
Yeah, and they've got the calendar, links to all the website, all the races, and they actually posted something. They asked if anyone has, like, course preview videos to send them to them, and they're going to make a compilation with each race venue of, like, YouTube links to the courses so that you could go and research courses with course ride previews through their website.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking, that we're going to do a Nationals course ride video?
Yeah, we should do it. That would be so great.
It's actually funny. I'm getting off topic here, but there are like four different course ride videos in America right now. There's and they all have slightly different approaches. There's Bill Shiken's, which is like the professionally shot, aesthetically pleasing one. There's Kerry Werner, which is like the kind of serious, kind of funny one. Then sometimes there's the Becca Faringer one, which is like full-on Gong Show course preview. And then there's the Curtis White course preview, which is I call Curtis White is super pro man in my book. He's like the consummate professional, and his course preview video is that. And honestly, if you were to watch a course pre-ride video wanting to learn something about the course and how you should race it, you should probably watch Curtis's. If you want to learn something, I don't know, about someone that Carrie's riding with, you should probably watch Carrie's.
And then if you just want to watch, you just want to know what the course is like, you watch Bill's. And if you want entertainment, you watch Becca's.
Yeah. If you want entertainment, you should just, everything Becca does is fairly entertaining.
So, but yeah, anyways, I thought that was super interesting, what they were doing, and valuable as well. Like, for just how many race courses there are out there, because we often try to watch the races, and then you get a sense of the course, but course ride videos are nice too. What kind of pre-ride video do you think we would do? I think we would be a disaster.
Yeah, if you want a disaster, you watch Jen and Mike's pre-ride video, where it's like the GoPro dies halfway through because we didn't charge it.
But no one in Canada is doing them. So if we do one for nationals, we'll get all the views.
Best pre-ride video in Canada.
Premium video cycling content. So, okay, anyways, Ruby and Sydney are both listed as being 23 years old on the UCI rankings, which is their racing age this year. So that means they're elites.
Ooh, so there's some, there is maybe some stiff competition here. There is Megley Rochette, Jen Jackson, Sandra Walter.
No, I don't get I don't get listed second. We go ranking.
No, we go in order of previous year's nationals results.
Oh, previous. Gosh, this is a lot to live up to.
Yeah, and then
lifetime ago,
Sydney and Ruby. Now the first two call ups are definitely Megley and Sydney because you folks have not done any UCI races.
Yeah, so the call up will be. We're ruining our next episode of our nationals preview by doing this now, but we'll do it again later. We'll do Megley, Sydney, Siobhan Kelly, Ruby, and then there's a lady named Cindy Koo and Evoldsen, who I do not know who that is, she has 3 UCI points.
Who's a Canadian?
I have no idea what race she did. Anyways, let's not ruin our next episode because we're just talking about nationals now, but it's because I'm excited
to be. I'm actually excited too, because for a number of years here, I have firmly believed that Mr. Gunnar Holmgren is the person you know how it's like, of course, going into nationals, anything can happen. Anyone can beat you. There are a lot of good, especially mountain bikers in Canada. But Gunnar's always been the person who I felt like we could both have a good day and he could still come out ahead, right? So he's an elite this year. I don't know if he's racing, but I'm putting it down here. Gunnar, you should really be racing nationals, because I think we've had some good battles on the day 2 of nationals before. He got me like 3 years ago, and I got him last year, and they were both great races. I really hope he's planning on racing nationals, because I would love to have like a good head-to-head Gunnar versus myself battle.
I hope the mountain bikers come out. I know some people drag their season really late, like Gunnar and like Marc-André Fortier is another one. They drag their season long. I think they just finished up some racing in Greece this past week, and they're on their way back now. So their season has run really long. So there'll probably be some downtime. And then if they do cross nationals. So, I really hope they come and they can be like, you know, bring a good race, because it's always better when you come into it like, you know, you want to feel a little bit of heat, right? It's not fun if there isn't a race to be had. And I think Peter will probably do it too. Carter is under 23, but again, it's like, how much are they putting into it? It's happening where they live, so they'll probably do it and it'll be fun. But I hope you get to have a good race, but I still hope you win. But
thank you.
I want it to be a good race.
I hope I have a good race and I win as well. But I would like, it'd be great to be like, I'm going to do nationals and I'm going to win by a ton. But it's not the same. Like, if I'm going to win a national championship, you want to know that you beat the best of who there was to beat, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
it's just unfortunate there aren't any other guys really pursuing cross. I know Brody will be elite. And he was not far behind you in a few of those World Cups as well. So I think he'll be focusing on that to bring some form. But there's not a lot. I mean, there's not a lot of females either. But on the women's side, there are, you know, Sydney's committed to the World Cup calendar. Ruby was, you know, did a whole season in Europe last year. I'm taking this like medium seriously, so we can all like, we know, I know there's at least three of us who are going to come and try and give Magalie a good run for her money, but you just don't know on the men's side if anyone's like really trying to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. And it's, but again, it's like Canada's male mountain bike side is like, it's deep. Yeah, there's no one who's really was like a perennial top 20 in the World Cup this year, but there's a lot of guys who are top 20 to top 40 or top 20 to top 60, which like at a mountain bike World Cup is still really good. So it's all who shows up and who is racing, interest in racing cross, and who has like been able to keep things rolling for the last few months of the season, or took a break and is kind of reinvigorated. Like, I mean, I hear Kabush is racing, so you can't count out Coach K.
I heard that rumor too. I also heard that Katarina will race on the Sunday.
And that she's going to be his pit crew. That's the most important part. Yeah. I was speaking of, we're getting really sidetracked here, but speaking of epic cyclocross / mountain bike stage racing, Katarina Nash with racing in Wisconsin, racing in Fayetteville, racing the short track at Oz Trails, racing the, what's it called? Backcountry race at Oz Trails, and then driving through the night to race the World Cup in Iowa. So if you were counting, that was 4 days of racing in a row. That was 5 days of racing in 7 days with something like 18 hours of travel thrown into the mix, not to mention all like the getting to and from the courses stuff. It was kind of ridiculous.
Some people just have a penchant for doing epic things and just being epic.
Katarina is one of those people.
So, yeah, I don't think we were getting distracted at all or sidetracked. You know, you kept saying that, but I don't think that any of this was sidetracked. This was all on topic. I have,
you know what? If you
three
never
bullet points here,
if you never have a plan, here, you're never off plan.
This is true. But I did write down 3 points for a small plan. We talked about the USCX series. We were going to talk about Cincy a little bit, which we did. And then a little bit about Nationals and Pan Ams. Actually, I had 4 points. And the other one was your highs and lows. What were your... We can finish with that. Ooh. Your best... How about your best things from this race block? Your worst things. You can pick like two of each. And then the most valuable takeaway.
All right there, coach.
Yeah, that's
what I'm here for. So I think my best races, we kind of talked about that already. It was Iowa. Like, I felt like I just put together the best day. I was the most dialed in mentally that whole weekend. I had a great Friday as well. And I, you know, I executed all of the things around the race really successfully that weekend. And that makes such a big difference. Like, you know, one of the other high points was coming into Roanoke really fast and getting that podium on the first day, but you know, the low point kind of followed that is I immediately forgot how to do all of the stuff around the race, and yeah, had trouble with the heat on day two, but probably also kind of took myself out of it, which is like, for how long I've been racing, is just not a smart thing to do by not being good enough about heat management, not being good about enough about post-race nutrition the day before. So I think that I was able to take that as a good learning opportunity. Like, it's just been a while since we've raced. You forget these things.
Totally. You forget how to, it's just like you fall out of practice. And that's like, remember I think we talked to Cam a while ago, and he said that like the racing came back quickly, but it was like just being dialed around the racing. That was, you just felt so scattered. You knew what you had to do, but it wasn't just a routine that you fell into naturally because you haven't been practicing that. You practice training and you kind of practice racing in your training, but it's also practicing everything around it.
And it's funny how dialed in you can get at the end of a 6 week block. It's like, yeah, maybe the physical and fatigue was setting in, but there's a moment, I think it's Cincinnati, where like I was warming up on the trainer and without even realizing it, like, you know, the clock ticked over to 20 minutes before the race, and literally in sync, like myself and Leaf swung our legs off the bike, and you're like, all right, we've done this. Like, we're ready to go. We know what we're doing. It's like, oh, 20 minutes before the race, we're done. Time to put the kit on, roll to the start line. And it wasn't it becomes such an unconscious thing, and that stuff matters too. It's like even just the finishing the race, getting back on the trainer, eating your food, all that stuff. It seems so hard when you haven't done it for 8 months. It seems so easy these last few weeks.
That's a good thing to learn too, then, I guess, is just like the process of going through it. It comes.
Mm-hmm. Besides that, like, I think with my racing, I feel like I'm just in a slightly different headspace than I have been in years past. I think I've been a little bit more ornery and mostly in a good way about my racing.
Siri, define ornery.
I've been less happy with mediocrity. I don't know if that's how you want to define it, but like, there was more times this past 6 weeks when I was like fired up and pissed off after the race for one reason or another, than has probably ever happened before. And I think it's because I'm expecting more out of myself. I'm expecting to be battling for these podiums, to be racing, you know, at the front all the time. And it's a blessing and a curse. Like, for me, that's something I needed to get to. It's not always my natural inclination. I don't have, like, this great killer instinct built in. It's something that's very much learned. But at the same time, it probably makes the highs and lows a little bit more pronounced throughout the season. And trying to find the balance between... Normally, I'm successful. I think one of the reasons in a cross season, because I don't have a lot of highs and lows. I'm pretty even-keeled throughout everything. And, you know, trying to balance that with being a little bit... expecting a little bit more from myself and letting myself be... It's okay to be upset at something every now and then. It's okay to care, right? So trying to find that balance point between looking at the picture, looking at the big packed picture from 30,000 feet, and letting yourself get like caught up in the moment and caught up in like what happened in the race and being super emotionally invested in what's going on right then. So I'm not sure if I've nailed that, but definitely the warming up and cooling down process is a part of my race now. I use that 20-30 minutes on the trainer to get totally in the zone and get completely psyched up and, you know, fired up, upset, angry, ready to rip some legs off. And by the same token, it also takes the cool down period, I think, to get out of that sometimes and to like wind down and get back to enjoying the rest of the day, because at the end of the day, it's like, you raced your bike. It was fun. You know, it's not that bad. It's good no matter what you do.
It feels like you just spoke to my existence this year too. It's like that feeling where like, yeah, I was so frustrated all season because I felt like I'd done the work to level up. And then even if I kind of showed that I maybe had leveled up in a few races, it just wasn't consistently every race. I wasn't able to be at that slightly higher level. The level was still pretty good all year, but most of the time I was just frustrated with feeling like I had more to give and I just couldn't figure out how to make it happen. And I think it's channeling that frustration and making it actionable, as opposed to, again, just like being mad about it. I'm glad, like, when I get upset or I get nervous, it's like, well, I care. I'm not just reacting for the sake of reacting. I'm reacting because I'm super invested in this and it matters to me, but I need to do something about it. And that's where you have, like, if you have good people around you, they can help you make those decisions and make the changes. So then you're not alone and just trying to figure this out. Like, sometimes, again, the 30,000 foot view is sometimes best seen by someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I never race well when I'm not nervous, when I'm not really invested in what's going on. Like, I don't think I've ever had a good race where you're on the start line and be like, huh, well, we're here, this will be fine. You just can't. Sometimes I think if you go into a race thinking that it'll be fine and thinking that it won't, I don't know, I need to mentally prepare myself that it's going to hurt and going to be hard and I'm going to, like,
it's going to be the biggest fight of your life.
Yeah. And then if you mentally prepare yourself for that, you get there and you're like, yeah, I'm here. Like, I'm ready for this. I thought it was going to be worse than this. Like, I can do this. Whereas if you go into a race being like, yeah, I should win this, it'll be easy. It's never easy.
You need to be able to embrace like what you need to bring and what it's going to be like and not let it scare you. And like one thing I found is my best races, I'm nervous. And like I know if it's the right kind of nerves. I had that before nationals, before the race. Like in the morning, I was like, I'm nervous. This is good. And then being able to like internalize that. And I've been trying to figure out like, how do I get that feeling? And I don't think I can really generate that. It just comes from caring and just feeling like I need to do. If I do what I can do, it could be a really good day. Things could really
for sure.
And then you don't feel like that all the time because you're not physically in a state like that or mentally in that place all the time. But it's trying to make that happen more often.
Mm-hmm. And I know, like with this trip, I knew it was time to go home after Cincinnati because it was getting harder to feel that way about Cincy. As much as everything in my brain was like, this is an important race to you, you want to do well, there wasn't that. I was also tired. There wasn't that spark, exactly. It wasn't coming easily. And like, you can do all the things to try and get there. Like, I don't change my pre-race routine. And I think I pulled together an okay weekend, but it wasn't the same as some of the ones previous to it.
Yeah, it's a good time to take a break, right? And that's what you're doing now. So then we're kind of like segueing out here. This is great. So we have some, you're taking some downtime.
Yeah.
And then nationals are in about 4 or 5 weeks from now. We have like a local. I'm going to come down and hang out. We're going to do a local race in the next bit. And then it's a couple races, nationals and Pan Ams.
Yeah.
That's kind of it for North America.
Yeah. And then I'm kind of starting to plan my trip for Europe. For me this year, I think the World Cups are kind of, I mean, obviously I'm not doing the full World Cup calendar because it's kind of insane now, but the World Cups are priority number one. There's just more value for me doing those as opposed to a Super Prestige or a X2O series. There's more points, more prize money, more media, more caring, more everything around those. And I have an easier time getting excited for them too. Like, I think even with races in Europe, I've gone to Europe for a lot of years. Like, I'm not that excited to race Lonehout. It's a cool course, it's a party atmosphere, it's all these things, but I've also done it like 5 times. I want to race something else, something different. New field, new course, new place, you know.
You just want new muddy fields to run around like Dendermonde.
Exactly. I want like, you just look across. Chilliwack could actually host a race like Dendermonde. You just find the muddiest field and you put like 7 corners in it and call it a day.
Let's aspire to better courses than that. Great racing too.
All right. Well, let's call that a wrap. Maybe we'll do an in-person live podcast for Aldergrove in 2 weeks.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah. We can
break down the local scene. It'll be so good. I'm so excited.
Get sound bites from other local... That sounds too professional. We're not doing that.
We can't say we're going to do too much because 90% chance we won't do it. This is easy to do because it's actually just catching up and talking about racing. But when you start adding all these ancillary things, it becomes too much work.
Absolutely.
Let's keep it fun. And we'll see you in a couple weeks then.
All right. Thanks, Jen. See you in a couple weeks.
Catch you later.